are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Yes, you are, and we're back. I'm Michael Sterling.
You are. Yes. You're back, and you're bigger than ever.
And who are you?
Yes, I'm May Studley Hungwell. Thank you. I'm here
really?
All week, ladies and gentlemen.
We're going there
you like
already,
where I'm going
huh?
already? It's hot. Yeah. I'm.
You know that's
I'm,
what you said, Paul Sterling.
I'm not thinking logically. I'm making tasteless jokes at the start of the show.
Yeah.
It's just too hot.
And even off before we started
well, that's,
the show.
Well, yeah. that's what I do.
Always tasteless.
You know,
it's but, if you weren't, I'd be worried, you know. Yeah. So
no, it yeah. is. It's like... You know, my father moved to Arizona. I tell you that?
Yes.
And, you know, he got very tired of the, you know, it's the dry heat. It's, you know, it's 120, but it's the dry heat.
Now, is this your mother talking?
My mother telling him that.
Oh, I see.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So his response to that was, yes, it is a dry heat, but so is a convection oven. And that's really how it is if you're ever in Arizona.
That's true. Just, I'd say that again in your father's voice. He does.
My father,
say that again.
My father is just, you know, I used to do a show called Straight Up with a Twist and about a straight guy that is perceived as gay. It predates the whole metrosexual label that
we had. With the big tagline, the greatest tagline in the world.
The world's a cruel place when you're a straight guy with good taste and a great eye for color.
There you go.
So, anyway. Yeah. But my father, that was my father's line. He says, when my son was born, I don't even remember it now, but when my son was born, I was a little shocked because I had hoped that both of my sons would be boys. That was the joke. I had hoped that both of my sons would be boys. Old world Italian. What are you going to do?
Very,
let's welcome, thank our sponsor.
I think Michael, we should. Yes. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, ladies and gentlemen, the entertainment standard used around the world, casting standard, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. And to learn more about Breakdown Services, visit them at BreakdownExpress.com.
We'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We are grateful to them for lending their support to our live arts calendar.
Are we ever? Yes, Mike Napoli over there and his crew. Hello, Mike. Writer, actor, and activist Timothy Congreve's best-selling memoir, Holding the Man, winner of the United Nations Human Rights Award for nonfiction and listed as one of the 100 favorite Australian books by the Australian Society of Authors, is one of Australia's great love stories.
You got a lot of Australias in there.
Yeah.
We tucked those in very well. And the stage version by Tommy Murphy captures all its special magic. Producers Nick Hardcastle and Nate Jones launched their newly formed Australian theater company with the Los Angeles premiere of Holding the Man, featuring an all-Australian cast and directed by veteran Hollywood acting coach Larry Moss. Opening night is May 10th at the Matrix Theater. Great
indeed,
space.
And we'll be speaking with Nick and Nate in just a few minutes. But first, Paul, let me ask you, how was your week?
Well, we'll throw some applause there.
Oh, yes, of course. Ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Yes. They're here.
Thank
they're
you
live.
So much. Please, we just want to make sure that people know that there's actually other people in the room. Welcome, gentlemen. Nice to have you both.
Thank you. It's
great
to be here.
So how was your week, Paul?
My week was good. I'm going to keep it brief, but we opened a show, the Seaglass Theater, of which I am managing director. We opened our production of Wake at the Fremont Center Theater in beautiful South Pasadena, California, and couldn't have gone better. Standing ovations, packed houses. We have 3 reviews out so far. Five stars, Critics' Choice.
Yeah.
Couldn't really delightful. And it's a very unusual piece because it's about an agoraphobic mortician. It's a woman who's an agoraphobe and she won't leave her house, but her home is also her business, which is a funeral home. And she's recovering from a devastating loss. And the best thing we heard the whole weekend, and I probably heard it half a dozen times, was I was sobbing and at the end of the sentence I was belly laughing. Just that emotional roller coaster that you really try to accomplish. You know?
Well, so, I agree. I was there, so I saw it.
Yes.
And yeah, fantastic.
Yes.
Good work.
Yeah.
As you always do, Seaglass Theater always does amazing work.
We do one show a year, but we put everything into it.
Right.
So I'll do a little shameless self-promotion.
Is James Denton going to show up?
James is not. James is not going to be in town for this one.
You know who James Denton is, right?
One of our...
Desperate Housewives?
He was Mike the Plumber on Desperate Housewives, and he's one of our... on our board, and an old friend and a great supporter.
Yeah.
Shameless self-promotion. promotion. Seaglass Theater. Theater has the R-E spelling. Seaglasstheater.org has all of the info. What's that?
As it should.
As it should. For those of us who know that. The old thing was that theater R-E is the art and theater E-R is the building. Is that what it is?
That's apparently here what it is.
Oh, okay.
In this room only.
Yeah, you'll have to explain to us what it is. What it is over there.
My goodness!
But thank you for asking, Michael. And how was your week?
Absolutely. You know what? It was good. Overall, good. I did go and review Mikhail Baryshnikov at the Broad Stage.
Yes.
In Santa Monica, and I'm really not going to elaborate on it in our arts calendar. I'm just going to get it up front here. Such a disappointing production. It was
really,
hard. First of all, Chekhov plays two love stories that have been reimagined by his company, which incorporates visuals that were very cool, I might say, and special effects, very cool. But the overall sitting there for 90 minutes without an intermission and listening to Chekhov being reimagined and hardly being able to understand it, let alone hear the actors who were... There was something with the sound system. On
the Oh, really? Night. Really?
And especially with Mr. Baryshnikov, who really is, a lovely gentleman. I've met him in the past and seen him on Broadway, and he does fine work. But in this venue, it just did not fly. So there were people leaving, and it was...
Really? Do you think a technical thing that could have been remedied and then it would have been worth it, or were there too many other flaws?
I think the technical part probably was remedied, but I don't think the overall experience was worth the trip.
Because this Broad Theater...
Brokenhearted to even say that.
This Broad Theater is this, multi-million dollar space, brand new, on the campus of Santa Monica College.
Yeah.
A beautiful, beautiful venue. I can't imagine that someone's in trouble over that.
Yeah, I mean, that's my personal opinion, and I don't think the show fared well critically, but it was a disappointment, actually.
On to better productions, as much like the one we are discussing today.
Absolutely. We are so pleased to be welcoming from Down Under the two principals of the newly formed Australian Theatre Company, which to date has been met with incredible enthusiasm by the Los Angeles community, hopefully the precursor to becoming a mainstay fixture in LA's better-than-ever booming stage scene.
Our first guest from the ATC is one of the company's two producers. He has enjoyed an extensive career in the entertainment industry through theater, television, radio, and music as both a talent and creative. Acting credits for TV include Home and Away, All Saints, Flat Chat, Pizza, Changi.
Yeah. As in Singapore. Okay, keep going.
No,
I'm really enjoying this. This is great.
Changi, the beautiful people for the BBC, as well as many credits as a TV host. I'm so glad you're enjoying me mangling the language.
You're actually reading my bio verbatim.
Stage, hey, we're busy here. We wear all the hats.
No, it's good.
We're very anal.
Look, I'm just reading the cards you hold up, pal. You hold up the flash cards and I read them. Stage credits include Australian premiere productions of Something Cloudy, Something Clear, Cliffhanger, An Adult Evening from Shel Silverstein, a far too underproduced production. It's a hysterical show. Mm-hmm. Girls Night Out. UK premieres include Nursery Crimes, Reuben Guthrie, and the world premiere cast of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, the musical in which he alternately appeared as Felicia. He's live and here in living color. Please welcome Nick Hardcastle.
Yeah!
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I love getting
well, Nick, we're out of time.
Band welcome.
We're out of time. I'm sorry.
Thanks so much for having me. We're out of time. We've read your bio. Now it's time.
We've read your bio, and now we just filled the time. What are you going to do?
I've been around.
How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you so much for having us on
here. We're so happy to have you.
Particularly for supporting our new company, not just our new work, but that really means a lot to us, especially, being kind of foreigners here in your cultural landscape and trying to integrate, but at the same time, establish ourselves and our voice. It's really nice to be welcomed by you.
He just said something, Paul, that was very... I must have him try to repeat what he said at the Council General's reception for the Australian Theatre Company.
I love the way you throw that off like it happens to you every week.
Well, no, it doesn't happen to me every
No, I remember. I
every
remember.
Other week.
Every other week, yes.
But no, he got up to speak toward the... at the shank of the evening and was saying just that about your voice being heard. And then you went through various items that were specific to Australian speak, if you will.
Yeah.
Can you repeat those? Because, I really didn't know what they were. You listed them, but...
Well, I was just saying, obviously... Australians grow up listening to American voices. We watch American films, TVs, we read their books, we listen to their music, and we feel very familiar and comfortable with American culture, certainly American popular culture as well. And so when we come over here, it feels very familiar. Even though it is definitely a distinctly different culture to ours, we can kind of assimilate and integrate and work it all out, but we're not always as easily understood because we're kind of represented by these outdated stereotypes that are more iconic, you know, that kind of make their way into the culture here. But I think what I was saying was, maybe by sharing our voices and telling our stories here, we might be able to avoid the horrified looks that we get next time we say we're just going to slip our thongs on and whack a load in the boot and, you know, duck out for a tick.
Which was confusing. Like
so by thongs, I mean flip-flops, and by whacking a load in the boot, I mean putting some items in the trunk of the car.
Oh. Whacking a load in the boot.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
It got a laugh.
No, I did that once in college, but I was experimenting.
You were arrested.
Oh, wow.
Continue.
Wow. Are there more?
There's so many more. Plenty more. We don't have enough time.
Oh, please. Go ahead. Yes, we do.
Whack a load in the boot. I just want to isolate that soundbite so we can say, State of the Arts, where we whack a load in the boot. And just have that be our outro now. Just our little sound.
I think the other one that kind of gets people a lot is the word root.
Root. But,
yeah.
Yes.
So, is this, what's the rating on this show?
Well, by the way, you'd be a little cautious.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, look, root is an Australian kind of slang term to describe sexual intercourse.
Uh huh.
Having a root.
Well, we have a variation here. Rutting. It's like if two animals are engaged in sexual congress, mm-hmm. it's rutting. Like you say, rutting like pigs.
Got it.
It's like a farm term.
Got it.
Don't ask me why I know. Don't ask me why I know.
On the farm in the Bronx.
All the sexual farm terms. I'm your guy.
This show is reaching a new low today. Yes.
Oh, yes. So root is much like rut. Yes.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Apparently. Except you do.
People say you don't want to root.
Is that it?
You want to root.
Or root you? Or go root yourself? Well, that's attractive,
Maybe not so much.
Not so much that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what you're going to chime in on. That's what you're going to weigh in on. Not so much that.
Just came out of a stupor with those farm animals.
I know. I threw him. It's not that. It's the photos I'm showing him off my. Okay, so now my question is, you talked about assimilating or getting here for this culture. Before we talk about the production, what is it you miss most about home right now, aside from obviously family and friends, food-wise? I'm always curious.
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't want to sound spoiled. I mean, well, look, let's face it. The food at home is, I believe, probably the best in the world. It's one of the things that I can happily spruik with pride that Australians are doing a lot right when it comes to the way that they sustainably farm, the way that they, you know, their produce, their, you know, the way that we cook. You know, Australians are, you know, we make the best coffee in the world anywhere.
You can get a good cup of coffee
anywhere, even at the
anywhere
local.
Like it's,
and we also have something that I really enjoy, which is that we have a real personal touch in terms of the cuisine and the type of restaurants. And you know, we're not anti-chain, but you know, we're not really into that kind of homogenized landscape of eating. There's a lot of local restaurants and diners and chefs and.
And so many different cultures as well.
Yeah, and a lot of because of the immigration in Australia has had different boom times. You know, like the 50s and 60s, which was the Greeks and Italians and the other Europeans, and then of course, you know, from the 80s, a lot of the Asian. You know, we've got a real mix of what is considered Australian cuisine.
Wow.
You know, very Mediterranean, and then inspired with Asian influences and that kind of stuff. And it's very a lot of the time very clean food, very you know, very flavorsome, very light.
It's interesting because, you know, a lot of people equate a lot of things about Australia with England, of course.
Yeah.
It's just a kind of a natural thing. I think we're probably the most guilty of that, the Americans. But and the English food is nothing like you're describing.
Well, you know, it's funny.
It's all very meat and potatoes.
Traditionally, English food isn't. But England has come along leaps and bounds.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the food revolution in the UK of the last 10 years has surpassed any other country, I think. You know, Australians were very progressive and well ahead of the UK, I believe. But the UK is, I think, you know, you just have to look at people like Gordon Ramsay, Jamie Oliver, Nigella Lawson, sure. Like people who have been campaigning over there and who have helped change that whole landscape. And the way that British people eat now is very different. Like maybe not so much in the villages. It's probably very much a baked potato and bangs and mash and whatever. But if you see the landscape of London, I mean, the food is
great. I read an article recently about, London really being one of the top five, you know, restaurant cities in the world.
Definitely.
And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, British cuisine was almost a punchline.
Yeah.
If you said that term, British cuisine, you know, so what do you mean? You know, but that's fascinating because once again, echoing what Michael said, we're as Americans guilty of this. One does not think of Australia as being a culinary hub for those of us who are outside it. I don't see it featured often. I watch a lot of the cooking shows, the Anthony Bourdain things.
Yep.
I'd be excited to see that.
Well, I think part of the reason why you don't is because Australia is so isolated from the United States geographically that, you know, it would have to be a very specific reason for you to travel over there and do something. You know, it's harder.
Right, it's just harder to get there.
Yeah.
Harder
and it's expensive as all hell. Yeah. I mean, Australia is so expensive, whether it's to go and
more
make
more expensive than here?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Food, everything.
Really
expensive.
I mean, obviously with the way that the economy has been in recent times, you know, Australia was not really affected by the global financial crisis that really hurt America and the United Kingdom. And so with that happening, you know, you see this, what was once a pretty, worthless currency suddenly was on par and, in fact, higher than the US dollar.
Right.
We kind of peaked at like $1.09 US, which was unbelievable.
Oh.
So for someone from the US to go over there now, knowing that wages have been pretty fixed, you know, over here for a little while trying to get through this tough period, you go over to a holiday in Australia now, it's going to hurt.
yeah. Well, I did a show with a wonderful, wonderful Australian actress a couple of years ago at the Edgemar Center Theatre in Santa Monica, Lucy Honigman.
Oh, Lucy. Yeah. We know Lucy.
Do you know Lucy?
Yes. Lucy's a great, great actress.
Do you really know her? Lucy, how wonderful is that?
Lucy was actually involved in this project very early on.
Are you with that group that she used to hang with that would go to the Outback and go to Outback Steakhouse?
No.
She had this whole, and it was all Aussie
Wait
friends
a minute.
Of hers.
There's an Outback Steakhouse in the Outback?
No. This was here. It was like a joke. Every couple of months, they would all go to Outback together, and they're all really Australians, and they would just have drinks and laugh. But no, Lucy is a wonderful actress. I don't know, is she still in town?
She's actually back in Australia. She was actually set to do this production, and Lucy's actually the main reason as to why Larry Moss is directing this show.
Oh, because of the Larry Moss connection at Edgemar Center, right?
Well, yeah,
because he used to teach classes there.
Well, I was actually auditing a class, Larry Moss's workshop one day, and Lucy was participating in the class, and I knew that the show was coming up, and I, you know, with the rights and stuff, and Lucy was there, and I was like, oh my God, you'd be perfect. So I approached her, and then her and I were having coffee a couple of months later, and I said, oh, what do you think if we ask Larry Moss to direct this? And we both kind of started laughing, and she's like, yeah, well, that would be great if he'd say yes. And so we just did. So it's thanks to Lucy that.
Oh yeah, no, Lucy. We did a production of Ghosts at the Edgemar Center.
Yeah, yeah.
I was the minister, and she was the maid on the make. She was wonderful.
Lucy.
Yeah.
Oh,
stunning
okay.
little
brunette.
Very,
right?
Yes.
Yeah,
I remember
just,
her.
And just so so funny. She used to
tell
a story about, because she has red cheeks, Lucy, and she used to tell this story about which she'd go into this salon. There's an Asian woman in the salon, and she'd just like touch her cheeks, and Lucy would do this voice of this woman saying, "Is this real? Black doll." And I must have made her say that like two dozen times.
How wonderful is that? Okay, so Holding the Man, this production, is the production company that you formed a result, or did you do that and then do, like, what was the causal event? What was first?
No, we... The production, the chicken and egg scenario is the play came first. As Nate kind of said, he was working on the idea that he wanted to produce the play at some point, and it was in very early stages. I, oddly, had previously been approached to do the show in London when it made its West End premiere a couple of years before. And unfortunately, they lost the theatre at the time that they were originally going to do it. And by the time they got the theatre the following year, my visa had expired in the UK and I was sent back to Australia to renew. And by the time I got my visa renewed, unfortunately, I missed the opportunity to do the show. And I was really devastated because I love this play. So when Nate started the process of, you know, developing this production, and it was still very early days, he put on a reading at the Coast Playhouse. And as fate would have it, I ran into one of the actors who was doing the reading
the night before
at the Hudson Theatre when I was seeing something there, an actress I really admire and had become, you know, recently quite good friends with. And she said that she was doing the reading and I was like, I must come and see it. And so I came and sat through the reading and they did a beautiful job of it. And I'd not met Nate before, actually. And I just wrote him a note and said, look, here's my connection to this play. If you decide that you're going to progress with this and you need any help, give me a call. And so Nate had obviously... known about me because I'm a big deal.
Yes, but the T-shirt is a little heavy-handed.
Anyway, so he gave me a call and we met up and just fell in love with each other immediately. We knew that we had similar visions and similar ideas and wanted to go in the same direction, and decided to work together at that point. And our first focus, of course, was making sure that we gave this play, which we both love, you know, life here in Los Angeles. But we, from the word go, knew that this wasn't going to be the first or last, you know, just the last thing, sorry, that that we would work on together. So we formed the company to create a framework for this production, but also for what we plan to do in the future.
And do you see yourself doing, like, there's a wonderful group in town called Theatre Banshee that does, obviously, primarily Irish-themed work. Do you see, like, as your mission statement, to stay with things of with an Australian flavor, or are you...
Yes, we do. I know
it sounds like an obvious question.
No. I mean, the thing is that what is important, though, is that we want to be a collaborative company. All of our creatives are American. Our director is American. You know, we, just because we want to share Australian stories or voices or our culture or our spirit, doesn't mean that we're trying to be exclusive. We want to collaborate and we want to integrate. It's just that this is our niche. You know, I think that it's really important when you're establishing your brand and your position and your voice in an arts community that you kind of know what it is. Yeah. And for us, it was a void. And there is a huge breadth of Australian talent in this country and in this city in particular. And I think people know now that that Australians, you know, are hardworking and that they can also, just because we're speaking now in our voice, it doesn't mean that we can't act as an American. I don't think that threat's there anymore, whereas actors probably in the past might have been frightened to act in their own voice here. Right. I think people now understand that we're, you know, our capabilities and stuff on that. So we're ready to get up on stage and
Along those lines, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
Along those lines, do both of you do American accents? Can you do?
Are you going to put us on the spot?
No. You don't have to. I'm just curious because once again, going back to Lucy, she was saying and echoed something you said.
We train having to do American accents. We train having to do British accents. We train,
of course.
You know, like I was saying before, we grow up on the work of these
companies. Well, no, that's the point Lucy made. So she said between The Simpsons and all of the shows that she loved, the American shows, she said getting the American accent was not a big stretch for her. Well, as opposed to going the other way, because very few Americans can really
exactly
master.
Exactly right.
They all lapse into British.
You're right.
They all lapse into British, and it's distinctly
some
different.
Some kind of Cockney.
But you know, of the two, British accents and Australian accents, I much prefer the Australian accent.
That's very kind.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. It's
much more interesting and ingratiating.
It's upward lilt.
Interesting is a word you could use.
Well, I think for us it's not so.
Well, I just find I lived in London for 5 years and our accent wasn't as welcomed there so much.
Really?
Because we're not considered the exotic creatures we are over here. It's kind of, there's actually a saying in London, which is, in London, you're never more than 2 metres away from a rat. Or an Australian.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Wow, that's a
culture
flash.
Yeah, we're everywhere over there.
Tell us how you feel.
You know what I wanted to say? I just have to share this little story. The first time that I had English food, because we're talking about the blandness of English food is what I was remembering, was I used to represent Andy Gibb for all of his career.
Oh, wow.
And his dear, sweet parents, Barbara and Hugh, used to cook dinner often for us and the boys, the Bee Gees. And, I was introduced to all of that food that way. And the very first thing that I ever saw cooking on her stove were Brussels sprouts. And about the 45-minute mark of them boiling, I said, Barbara, don't you think those are done? And she said, oh, no. And then we had the Brussels sprouts, and it was, you know, I mean, it was like mush in your mouth. It was so. It's not how I've ever had them prepared since that particular day. But I also never liked Brussels sprouts.
They had to boil the green right out of them.
Yes. Putting on the vegetables at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to eat it.
Exactly.
Because you'll enjoy our dinner and you won't need teeth.
Yeah, it was hilarious. But it was the beginning of Biff. Becoming acquainted with the food.
Before I forget, and we have to leave time at the end of the show, you have to tell your British accent story.
My British accent.
The British accent story about the...
being on the plane?
Yes. The one on the plane. If you can. But back to Holding the Man. Can you give a... well, first of all, let's give the information about how people can attend this production.
Absolutely.
We'll throw it out there. You want to do that?
Yeah, Michael? Certainly. It's in previews on May 8th and May 9th. That's right around the corner, with performances May 10th through June 29th. Thursday at 8 p.m., May 8th only is a preview, of course, and the Thursday dates are through the end of that period, June 26th. Fridays at 8 p.m.
It's June 29th.
I'm sorry.
I just want to correct you there.
Oh, yes, it is. You know, I'm sorry. I was talking about the Thursday part only, right? Because the last Thursday is the 26th.
Oh, God.
Yes, sir.
This is interrupted. Great plug.
Oh, well, there goes the rhythm. Goes the rhythm of this magical show.
Just ruined everything.
So basically, Thursdays through Saturdays at 8 p.m. through the 29th of June, and Sundays at 3 p.m., and the lovely matinees. I think I'm going to your May 11th matinee because I can't make your opening. I've got another assignment.
Oh, no, that's great. Because, we definitely want a good crowd on the 11th. You don't want anyone having those kind of post-opening night come downs when they look out and the crowd's a bit thin and they're feeling a bit, exhausted.
Second show slump, as they say.
Second show slump.
And that's at the... you want me to finish that?
No, go right ahead,
The Australian Theatre Company, of course, at the Matrix Theatre, one of our great little theatres at 99 Cedars in town, at 7657 Melrose Avenue. And that is west of Stanley Avenue, if you know the area between Fairfax and La Brea, of course. And how do we do it? How do you get tickets, Paul?
You call 323-960-7735. But the far easier thing to do is to go to holdingtheman.us. That's www.holdingtheman.us. Ticket price is $34.99. It's astounding what you can see and what quality theater you can see in this town for such a low price when you compare it against Chicago or New York. Holdingtheman.us, 323-960-7735. We will throw this out there a couple of times before the end of the
hour. And after our arts calendar here, oh my goodness, after our arts calendar, we're going to ask you a very important question about your show. Okay?
Great.
Yeah, so just be prepared.
Okay. We're ready.
I'm nervous.
Are you?
I'm nervous.
No.
It seems far important.
Now, we talked a lot about it, but we didn't get down to the core of what the actual story is about.
No, so we want to get a little synopsis, find out who their characters are and everything. We got talking to food. We started talking to food, and then you know how I do. You know how I am.
With food, when it comes
to food.
I know how you are. I know how you are.
Okay, so you have an Ars Calendar piece, right?
I do. I mean, other than the Baryshnikov experience, which, again, is only my opinion, ladies and gentlemen, and Mr. Baryshnikov himself, lovely, lovely man on stage and did some nice work. But when the special effects outweigh the content of the show, then we have a problem, or I have a problem anyway. But I did review the regional Los Angeles regional premiere of Tarzan the Musical, Disney's Tarzan the Musical, at the lovely El Portal Theater over the weekend.
Is this the one that Kristen Towers Rolls is
It is. It is. Yeah. And there she is.
Oh, there she is.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is the granddaughter of a very famous movie star of the past by the name of Catherine Grayson.
She was in the MGM Showboat, the
Kiss
film
Me
Showboat.
Kate Kiss and Me all Kate. Of those lovely musicals that she did. And the gentleman that plays Tarzan is Tyler Scherer, who is brand new to Los Angeles. And I must say that this was done also in their 99-seat theater. They have a large theater as well, but... This was, you walked in and the first thing that greeted you was this extraordinary set of the jungle, which was, what in the world? Because you very seldom see elaborate sets in 99-seat theaters. It's just not really possible in most cases. This was taking up half the theater. And the theater is in a crescent shape as far as the audience
is concerned. It's like a proscenium thrust. Yeah.
And while
just a thrust.
The show was not a major success on Broadway, but it certainly is being done in seasons around the country. And I must say that I actually enjoyed this very much. Musically speaking, there's some great Phil Collins songs in it, of course, and the performances that were given by the cast as a whole were very, very good in the direction and the choreography and so forth. And I must say for Kristen Towers' roles in particular that she's always good, this woman, and she was just in the... You know how one role is like so perfect for you as an actor, and that's kind of a role that you are so glad that you really did this in your career, and that's the kind of role that this is for her. She was very much made that character that we've come to know and love, that woman that went there and was a part of that experience come to life, as did this young man, who is not necessarily the legit singer that Miss Rawls is, but he has a more pop voice, which is kind of suited
for Phil Collins songs.
Right,
sure,
exactly.
Yeah.
And the ensemble was fantastic. I'm going to do a shout-out to Catherine Washington, who plays the female gorilla who becomes the mother of Tarzan in the show and raises him. And she did an extraordinary job, and it was her first primary role in Los Angeles, and she came into the theater world here through LA's Next Race Stage Star.
Holy cow.
Yeah, 2 years.
This is a competition that Michael oversees at his club. Michael has a supper club upstairs at the Federal in North Hollywood, and he does this thing for young performers called LA's Next Great Stage Star.
I love the Federal.
And, the room upstairs. Yeah. And it's just like a conduit for talent in this town.
Right, it is. We've started a lot of careers. We have 9 kids on Broadway right now that have all made their Broadway debuts, and some are on their 3rd and 4th show, and it's really a nice launching pad. But at any rate, I urge people to go see this. And it is produced by Eric Kelrick. And he is a young man that has brought his company into Los Angeles from up northern in Northern California. So here are the stats on this. It is very simple to go to the El Portal site, which is El Portal Theater with the R-E at the end, .com, elportaltheater.com, online, get tickets, or you can call them at 818-508-4200 or 866-811-4111, and it plays through May 18th, Fridays and Saturdays, and Sundays only.
Now, you know I live in Tarzana, right?
Yes.
Do you know why it's called Tarzana?
Why?
Because it was a ranch owned by Edgar Rice Burroughs, who wrote all the Tarzan books, and all the money he made from the Tarzan books, he bought this beautiful ranch, and then he deeded it to the city, so it's called Tarzana now. True story.
Wow.
Interesting. And this young man that plays Tarzan in this production, by the way, he is a very, very good actor.
What?
I mean, really a good actor, and he's very young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I saw the pictures. They look very interesting.
Good show. Yeah.
Back to Holding the Man, presented by the Australian Theatre Company. We have two of their guests here today. Well, let's before we get to the...
May I say just one thing? Forgive sure. me. I said directed by Eric Kelrick, and it's Eric Austin. His company is called Kelrick, so...
Oh, okay.
There you go. That's right. Tarzan, of course.
All right. Michael, would you give yes. Nate the intro he is so due?
I will. About which is not going to be as long as Nate's, but...
As we stated earlier, he is also one of the producers of the newly formed Australian Theatre Company in Los Angeles, and for their first venture, Holding the Man, he is also one of its stars. He has been seen on the Australian stage in A Chorus Line and in the feature film Restraint. Holding the Man marks his Los Angeles debut. Please welcome Nate Jones.
And he enjoys long walks on the beach, and his turn-offs include people who don't use coasters. And welcome,
and
Nate.
A little rooting now and then. Who knows? Who knows?
Thank you so much.
I just lost my audio. Was weird. Was it weird for you?
A little bit.
Did you hear that? Let's hear that.
Yeah, it's coming out of one ear.
It's only coming out of one ear. Oh, we lost half our
I got half the audience.
Okay.
Nick stole them all.
Damn him.
They're all going, I know Lucy Honigman too. Everyone does. Nate, can you give us sort of a synopsis? I was reading the thing here, but I'd rather hear it from you, the looking through the promotional material for our listeners, without giving too much away and wanting them and having them to still come see it. Can you give sort of a synopsis of the... Of this gentleman's memoirs, correct?
Yes. Yeah, Timothy Conagrave.
Yes.
It's a story about two boys back in the 70s that meet in a all Jesuit school in private school in Melbourne and fall in love. And this is a story about their 15-year relationship together.
15 years. Wow.
Yeah, the kind of highs and lows of their relationship.
And they're a bit of an odd couple, you know. Tim is the drama nerd at school, and
complete
John's the captain
nerd.
Of the football team, you know, the MVP, best and fairest. And it's, you know, it was a very unlikely match, but it's an enduring one.
There's an American novel called, I just went blank because I was thinking about it.
I loved that book.
There is an American novel. Yes.
One of my favorite American
Dancer
novels.
Dancer from the Dance?
Dancer from the Dance? You
I
just made
think
that up.
That was the name of it. No, it's similar, but it's something that Paul Newman optioned for himself.
Really?
And it was about the same type of storyline, but it was not a true story like this is.
Paul Newman and his wife, Joanne Woodward, were very big on in the 70s pushing or making more prominent the idea of homosexual themes in work. If you look at Rachel, great movie from the early 70s, one of the first films about lesbianism, mainstream films about lesbianism, a very, very good film. I don't remember who was in it, but I know it was very, very good. So the 70s, Melbourne at that time, was the... does he describe the culture as far as the intolerance being what we knew to be? Because for us, the 70s, I don't know when Stonewall was. I think it was the late 70s.
I think like 76. Yeah. Don't quote me.
When Stonewall happened here. But what was sort of the temperature in Australia at that time?
Oh, Australia was, you know, very, very... very it's homophobic, and especially, you know, 70s going into the 80s. And the surprising thing is that these boys, we've had a few conversations with through obviously, you know, our company knowing, you know, people that actually went to that college and people that went to school with these boys. And as kind of homophobic as Australia was at that time, and, you know, homosexuality actually, you know, the act of buggery being illegal. These boys were protected by the four walls of this school. Everybody knew, everybody was aware.
Wow.
Later in the stages of their relationship, everybody was actually aware that these boys were together, and it was kind of, they were kind of protected, because like Nick said, it was the captain of the football team, and he was,
it was like cross-cultural in the universe of the school.
Absolutely. And he was considered a god in this school. And, you know, for Tim really couldn't have chosen a more unlikely match, but it worked. And
but the heart wants what it wants.
It wants what it wants, and these boys fell in love with each other and were together for 15 years.
And when this play first made its debut in Australia, which was 2006.
2006, yes.
And it broke all sorts of records.
It did.
It won all sorts of awards.
Yeah, they only had set it up for, an initial six-week run, and it was so successful. You know, I think back then as well, it was a thing. The book itself, Holding the Man, the memoir, was very, it's kept in high regard, especially in the...
It's been reprinted like 18 times.
Yeah, in Australia.
United Nations Human Rights Award.
So there's a huge following for the book itself. But then when the play opened, I don't think that they had any idea of how successful it was going to be. And, you know, an initial six-week run turned into a tour of 2 years around Australia at some of the biggest theatre companies.
And also the fact that it engaged the hearts of the broader community, because I think that it's very easy for people to kind of hear a little bit about what it is and just assume that it's only going to reach a gay audience.
Right. Stamp a label on it and make your decision.
And that's the thing, and the audiences, and that's why what happened. And, you know, having conversations with the writer, Tommy Murphy, back at that time when it was opening, you know, the community, the greater community, you know, heterosexual audiences, they just all started coming in droves, but because it's just a story about love.
I was just going to say, isn't that the mark of a great work?
Of course. Absolutely.
You have all sorts of, you know, particular, you know, sexual orientations, mm-hmm. but if it's about, you know, if it's about two people loving one mm-hmm. another, it transcends all those, you know, boxes and labels that society feels the need to put us
universal,
all in.
Really, the universal message of this right. production is love. You know, being in love with somebody no matter who you are, right. regardless of who you are.
And I think, you know, when that message is written in a form that's, you know, really quite brilliant, that it's going to be accepted by even the worst of, you know, critics of those kinds of things.
Well, you know, it's also, I mean, just like Brokeback did.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Brokeback Mountain Good is example. A great example of that because, you know, on the surface, because you say gay Western, in effect, mm-hmm. or gay men in this sort of cowboy culture, and then the bad jokes come in. You know, right. I mean, we heard a lot. I heard a lot of that going into, you know, when that first came out. And then the piece of artwork comes out, and much like this, transcends, and people forget what they even said. They look at it for what it is rather than what they decided right. it was before they saw it.
Exactly.
You know, which is you're up against so much of the time.
And it was, a movie for all time. And, I mean, I think it stands, it will always be remembered, this film, as a very distinguished, very fine piece of art.
Now, have either of these gentlemen that the story is based on, have they seen the production?
No, they both actually...
Are we going to ruin the end?
Well,
No, you can leave it at that. Okay. But 15 years together, and the time that they were, you said boys' school, and then you said college, and for us it's distinctly different. Where is the age
So they met when they were 15.
Okay, so yeah, it would be a boys' school.
Yeah, and went, you know, through their relationship through university and, you know, being together and apart, and, you know, Tim actually, they were both from Melbourne, and Tim... ended up auditioning for NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art, where Mel Gibson, Cate Blanchett, Jeffrey Rush, Judy Davis, our drama school, National Drama School that they attended. Tim was actually a graduate of NIDA. So he moved to Sydney for a while they were still together. And and then the both boys ended up living in Sydney towards the end
of
their relationship.
And they're still together?
I think we need to actually explain this more, because it's very. I think that there's another very important, you know,
message
in here, and that is, you know, this play takes us through a very important time where the HIV/AIDS crisis was ferociously robbing us from some of the most beautiful people in our community, and that's also what happens in this story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the risk of giving it away, I think it's very important that we're telling this story at this time as well, where a whole new generation of people in this community have actually got no idea how serious and how desperate and how horrific this time was, and what it meant to the broader community at that time. You know, people were losing their loved ones, their chosen family members. You know, they were dropping like flies. You know, there was no understanding. So these poor people who are in a community that are already facing so much discrimination, you know, and especially, as Nate said, in Australia, the homophobia and that culture of machoism and whatever was so repressive. And then suddenly there's this gay cancer that's coming and wiping all of this retribution, you know, whatever it is, however it was packaged up and presented to outsiders who had no idea. You know, it was horrific. And so I think, you know, for us to represent this story at the moment in West Hollywood as well, and you know, at a time where I think these stories need to be retold, is also a very important part of this piece. And again, if you don't mind me saying so, again, I don't think that this play can be stamped with the AIDS play stamp either.
Right.
In the same way that it's not the gay play. It's a story of a time, a love affair, a generation, a period, and it's still a story of hope, even in spite of the ending, you know? It's not bleak.
Well, it's very hard to impart to people. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that time, and it's very hard to impart to people now because of the way medications have changed and all of this, that it was the plague.
Yeah.
It was. I mean, we had a theater company in Chicago called the Blind Parrot Theater, and in the course of 1 year, we lost 4 of our board members.
Yeah.
You know, and we only had 8 people on the board. I mean, it was just, you know, one example of millions and millions of examples that are out there. So,
and you were so right about that, because in young West Hollywood and places like that around the country, because of what you're saying, they tend not to pay too much attention anymore protecting themselves.
Absolutely, and I think there's a huge, you know.
And to understanding where where this has come from, you know, their ability to make these choices, their ability to behave this way, their ability to feel as free as they are, what the price that's been paid for that. They just, you know, a lot of people take that for granted, not just taking their health for granted or certain risks, but just because
there's a complacency,
their way of life.
And it's like you know, especially for the younger, you know, gay community, especially in West Hollywood and even in Australia as well, it's like a thing was, oh well, it's no longer a death sentence. I can just pop a pill now, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
It's like, are you kidding me?
I don't want to say a lesser degree because it's a completely different animal, but black activists like Dick Gregory and Bill Cosby and people like that have said the same thing. Mm. It's like the comfort that you enjoy now, or the safety that you enjoy now, was earned by people for you, and we need to recognize those people that earned, you know, or made things easier for you. But
You know, and that was one of my big reasons for especially wanting to come out to LA and tell this story, because if I can have one young man sit in that audience and just think twice about going out and having unprotected sex, it's like, you know, or anybody in that audience, then I've done my job, you know, as an actor, I've done my job.
Well, as an actor, you know, to have that as well as, I mean, you go up and you're imparting this wonderful play, but to have that as your mission sort of says that you really, if you have that in your heart, you're never going to mail in a performance. You always have that, you know, that.
Hopefully not. No, I mean, one thing, you know, just with my producer hat on for a second, I will say is none of our actors are mailing in performances, and that's a real credit as well to our director, Larry Moss. You know, anyone that understands who Larry is and his work will know that he's not about spectacle, he's not about any of that other stuff. It's about the performance, it's about bringing out the absolute truth. And these actors are so committed, and, you know, so our set, designed by John Iacovelli, who's amazing, is actually very simple. Our costumes are very iconic and raw. It's the sound design by Crick Myers is fantastic, and so is our lighting design by Jeremy Pivnik. But really, at the core of it, these actors are telling these stories in a very visceral way. It's very real. It's very, it's very compelling. It doesn't rely on anything else, you know. And so as a night in the theatre, I think people are going to get something quite extraordinary, you know.
I'd like to name those people because it's here and they should be called out to the other cast members. Cameron Daddo.
Very, very famous Australian.
Nate Jones.
Star.
Obviously, Nate, who's here with us. Luke O'Sullivan, Adrian Smith, Roxanne Wilson, Adam J. Yeend. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And, of course, Nick, producing, who's here with us as well.
And one more time, ladies and gentlemen, at the Matrix Theater, Holding the Man, and it comes up May 8th and 9th in previews and opens May 10th through June 29th. Yes. And that is the Australian Theatre Company. And simple to get tickets, 323-960-7735 or holdingtheman.us.
And one of the things I always like to talk about, especially at the Matrix there, it's one of those few places, West Hollywood and this area of West Hollywood, one of the few places in Los Angeles, because you have in so many other cities, you don't know what you have, where you can park and you can walk to a restaurant and you can walk to a bar afterwards. And it's invaluable here as far as we're so
we love
spread
the space
out.
There, and Joe's been great.
We need to baptize you guys.
And no, we're out of time.
We have two minutes.
We have 30 seconds. Actually.
30 seconds? Yeah. What's that clock?
No, because that's the wrong clock. We only have 30 seconds.
Let's go a little bit over.
What's the baptism?
If we can.
Real quick.
Worst thing to happen to you on stage? Embarrassing? Something that went south?
When I was actually doing a chorus line and we were coming out for the final number of one, my pants actually split. And it was actually on the day that I decided not to wear on any underwear or that I didn't actually.
So they got their money's worth on that day.
But it was actually from behind.
That sounds like a singular sensation.
It was a singular sensation.
Could have been
a
double sensation.
What do you have?
Oh, look, I've been completely full frontally nude on stage, so that doesn't bother me in the slightest. I mean, I've fallen over countless times wearing high heels where my heels have gone into the tracks on the stage, you know. Doing Priscilla the Musical.
I was going to say, you don't wear heels with everything.
Well, not with every. Every now and then I like to get them out, just, you know, for fun.
My date's a little taller.
To keep my calves in good shape. The worst thing, the worst thing was that I was sitting in my dressing room. I hated the show that I was in so much, Snow White pantomime. and I was in like, my like dressing room waiting like for my cue. I was playing Prince Charm. Charmless, actually. I think I had a complete charisma bypass in this show. And I'm sitting there watching a South Park episode on my laptop, just not even. And I hear the cue, you know, one day my prince will come, or something, whatever the cue was. And I'm there half dressed, robe on. I just went, oh, shh. And I bolted down the stairs, grabbing my, you know, and completely missed my entrance.
How late were you?
Oh, I was pretty late. They had to kind of, you know, reassemble the cast for the closing number. I kind of popped out at the end. And it was, I had a little bit of a stern talking
a real
to.
Professional.
Yeah.
So very professional. So
yeah.
One who's accidentally undressed and one that's just lazy. Gentlemen, what a pleasure to have both
indeed.
Of you.
Thank you so much for having us. We look forward to seeing you on the show.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And look forward to seeing the show. I'm definitely going to catch this one.
And we will see you, Paul, next week.
See you on the radio.
On the radio.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.